What's up, interpreters? I'm Heather Pressman. I am an educator and author.
What's up, interpreters? I'm Danielle Schultz. I'm a museum educator, accessibility advocate, and author.
What's up, interpreters? This is Heather, corporate engagement and partnerships manager at NAI.
What is up, interpreters? I'm Paul Caputo, executive director for NAI. So happy to be here talking with Danielle and Heather, who are the authors of The Art of Access. Danielle and Heather were kind enough to join us for one of our Interp Talk sessions where we got to talk about this title and its implications for the field of interpretation. So the subtitle of the book is A Practical Guide for Museum Accessibility. I'm going to jump in with a really basic question for you and Danielle and Heather. You can fight over who gets to take this one first. But what inspired you to write this book? Why is this subject important for us here and now?
So I have a friend who is blind and had a really interesting experience with her, which if you read the preface of the book or the introduction of the book, she's the person that story is about. And so I was able to see through her experience what was lacking in terms of cultural experiences. And that just made me want to start to do more, you know, in the museum field around access. I was able to see that she wasn't able to enjoy things in the same way that I was as a sighted person. So that was kind of what spurred me down the road of accessibility work. And then I was at the American Alliance of Museums conference in 2018, I think, and saw a sign that basically said, "Have a book idea, feel free to, you know, pitch it to us." And so I remember I emailed Danielle and I said, "It's okay to tell me if I'm insane, but what do you think?" Because we had already been doing conference sessions and different talks and things like that around the Denver area, around kind of like, what are 10 basic steps that you can do to get started in this work? And luckily, I guess, for me, she didn't tell me I was insane. So we pitched it and ultimately ended up writing the book a couple of years later. So,
yeah. And I think what's interesting is we were at all of these presentations had this long list of resources that we would share with people through a Google Drive, because there wasn't a single place where there was all this information. There was things about working with folks with low vision from the National Federation of the Blind. There was things about working with people who are deaf from over here. And so there wasn't a single resource that people who were starting out in this work, which Heather and I, that's how we connected, is we both worked in this. We were kind of siloed because usually at a museum, there's one person or there's half of a position. And so we connected to share resources. We kind of built up this network of other folks who wanted to share resources. And so we said, well, how do we, instead of just having this really clunky Google Drive, put it all together in one place to just say, here it is?
So did you just literally start pulling information? I mean, from experience, right? Because I'm like wondering how you start a book like this. And because there is sort of so much information, but at the same time, that information isn't anywhere in one place, right?
Yeah, like Danielle said, we were doing these sessions and everybody kept being like, oh, is there a book on this? Is there a book on this? And our answer was no, but here's a link to, you know, a hodgepodge of internet links. And so we, you know, in terms of structuring the book, we just sat down and sort of thought like, okay, like, you know, if you're first coming into this work, what do you need to know? You need to know that there's the basic history of disability rights in the United States, the laws. I mean, the ADA it'll be 34 years old this year. So it's, you know, new-ish in terms of all of that. You know, what implications that law, as well as other laws, have on you as a museum, and that varies depending on how you're funded. So like, it was important to know that information from the get-go. And then we just kind of broke it down by really broad disability types. So, you know, there's a chapter on cognitive access, there's a chapter on, you know, physical access tends to be what people think of first, which is why it's kind of early in the chapter lineup. But we also wanted people to think about bigger, you know, broader accessibility as well. So that's why there's a chapter on financial access, because that's something that's not often considered, but is actually really important, because so many people who have a disability are either underemployed or unemployed. And so they don't have a lot of extra cash to spend at cultural institutions.
The history of ADA, I found, well, I think I've told you this before when we were discussing it in book club, that there's so much like theoretical information, so much historical information, but also so much practical information in this book. And I think that's what makes it kind of so powerful and useful. But the history of the ADA, the different iterations of what has happened through the years, and like you were saying, Heather, it's just, it's not that old, and still people are fighting, you know, for rights. So anyway, I found that very interesting, that sort of mix again with the practical stuff that you were giving people that they could do right away. And maybe you want to talk about some of those things, like you had talked about kind of the top 10 things, you know, someone can do to make their site more inclusive and accessible.
Yeah, I think when we were writing it, we, you know, there's a lot of resources out there that do talk about the theoretical aspects of disability rights, and recognizing that that is extremely important because we all need to be housed in the history of it and know the whys. And yet knowing that the people who are in the field who have either been tasked with this because they want to, or because that has been added onto their job position, in order to make headway, in order to make movement, you have to be able to give those practical aspects. So that's why we gave a very, you know, very top level introduction, and then really wanted to say, and the first couple ones are really thinking about partnerships, because that's also what I think is so important in this field, is recognizing you're not alone. You don't need to know all of the information, and that there are people who have been doing this work for beyond 34 years, for decades, and want to share it, because the whole goal is that our entire world can become accessible and people with a variety of disabilities can access arts and culture content. And so that's really kind of the beginning ones, is we spend the first, I think, couple chapters really talking about partnerships, and both reaching out to your network, your local, your, you know, national affiliates, people just within your community, to kind of build this consortium. Because I think there can be a siloing effect of, oh my gosh, I have to do this by myself. I need to stay up late every night learning about all of these different aspects and theories and resources. And it's like, you don't, you just need to partner with other places, and also recognizing the people who are doing this work well, and how can you work with them? And how are you actually working with the users and saying, I need to put the users first. I think what can be tricky though, and we do talk about this in that, is kind of tokenism. And I have seen different organizations and programs saying, great, we've worked with one person who was blind to build our entire accessibility plan. I'm like, that is one person, that is one perspective. Even within the blind community, that is just one perspective. And so this recognition that you can't just put all of this on one person's experience, you have to be able to diversify, and you have to see it as a process. And I would say that that's something that probably in every single chapter we talk about. This is a journey. This is a process. This is not one thing that you mark and then you move forward to. And I think that's hard to hear, especially with administrators who are like, this is resource and time intensive. We want this to just be done. And it's, so it's also kind of this mind shift of, you need to be a learner. You need to be open to changing things, to failing, to trying things out. So I think that's kind of the big mind shift. And then really recognizing where you are and who your audience is. We talk a little bit about being in Denver, you know, there's a focus on engaging with language justice, engaging Spanish speakers. And so at the Denver Art Museum where I work, you know, we've really made a commitment to having all of our interpretive materials in both English and Spanish. We didn't want someone to read that book and say, okay, great, I need to propose that we're a bilingual museum. They might live, I think Heather's example was in San Jose, California. When they actually did a survey of who are the people coming to your museum, Spanish was not the second most popular language. It was actually, I think, an Asian language. So it's also like, don't just look at pinnacles of other museums and say, I need to really just mimic what they're doing. I need to really think about our community and what our communities are looking for. For example, my museum, Denver Art Museum, we really focus a lot of our work on sensory friendly programming to begin with. And that was because we had folks from that community coming to us saying, we want to be able to come to your museum. We need that. So instead of saying, oh, I'm sorry, I need to really focus this work on engaging the deaf community first, like, you have to make those choices because resources are limited. And so you have to make those choices based on who your community is and really get out there. And I think those are kind of, in my mind, the kind of top, the top practical aspects.
So I have to apologize. I misspoke when I said that you all were on InterpTalk. You were on the book club, which is a separate, different thing. And I conflated those two. So I apologize for that. I'm curious about, you know, this book was published in 2021. Heather, you said that you sort of had the idea for it a couple of years before, you know, before it was published. And obviously there was a ramp up to that moment of realization. So a minimum of 5 years, probably longer than that, of you, you're sort of, you know, reviewing how we're doing as a field with accessibility issues. Have you seen the awareness of accessibility issues change in that span of time? You know, how are we doing now compared to when you first thought, we got to put together a compendium of resources for people because we need to figure this out?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say starting in about, I mean, definitely in about 2016, when AAM, the American Alliance of Museums, included accessibility as one of the parts of their strategic plan, you started to see people talking about it more and thinking about it more. But like Danielle said, it's a, you know, it's something that takes resources. And so it's been really sort of slow to kind of ramp up and change. But it's been interesting, even in, I'd say, like the last like 3 years, there's been a shift in kind of conversation. Like, instead of people coming up and saying, I want to start doing this at my museum, they say, I am doing this at my museum and I need support. So there's been, and it's the other thing too, is that it's not just museum educators, which is typically where access falls, coming up to us and chatting. We're seeing a broader range of people working in different parts of the museum, as well as kind of experience levels. So it's starting to, you know, become a little bit more widespread, but it is slow because you have to make the case that it is important and not everybody understands why that is. We love to use Betty Siegel, who is with the Kennedy Center. She gives a great talk where, you know, she lays out the reasons why you should do this work. I mean, one, it's the law. That's pretty basic, right? Follow the law. But, you know, two, that it's the right thing to do. I mean, most importantly, I would argue, but that it also makes good business sense, because right now the estimates are something like 26% of the US population has a disability of some sort or another. And so those 26% of the population are making decisions about where they go and how they spend their money on whether they can actually access what you have to offer. But it's not just them either, right? Like, we don't tend to go to museums independently. We go with our friends, we go with our family. So it's those people who are making that decision as well. So that's a lot of dollars when you look at it, you know, from a financial perspective, which I don't love. I don't love that you have to do that, but.
And many of these changes don't just affect the community that you're trying to affect, right? I mean, that's, and I imagine that folks realize that after they, you know, painstakingly go through some of these processes, they're like, wait a minute, this affects a much wider population than just the population we were focusing on. Do you find that, or have you heard those stories?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of that also is from thinking about the timeline, is from the pandemic and people recognizing their, and being more willing to share about their needs and saying, I need to have these quieter times. I'm immunocompromised. So I am actually not feeling safe in spaces anymore, and museums having to react to that. And then people feeling more comfortable sharing about their intersectionality, right? How am I not just in one box, but actually across these different areas? And I think, to Heather's point about that statistic, about 26%, people think about disability as being something very visible and very physical. And there's been a great increase in people disclosing and feeling more comfortable sharing about I'm neurodiverse. I have these types of sensitivities. I need this. I have this type of you know, needs for museums to now address. And I think that has been a huge change. And also seeing it being now staff members talking about that. That I would say, and I know I've said this to Heather a ton of times, it's been so interesting to see in the past, I would say 2 years really, this increase in staff members saying, I need my disability and my accessibility to really come to the forefront. Because museums were always very forward facing. How are we reaching visitors? What are we doing there? And we're not always taking the same care to do that with our staff. And so I think having both of these sides of visitors as well as staff saying, we need to think about these needs, because we're also seeing the importance of museums. When we couldn't go to museums for almost 2 years, it's like, oh my gosh, that was such a hole in our lives. Like, we needed to get all of our basic needs met, but then it's really saying arts and culture are so important, surrounding us out. And when we didn't have access to those, that was such a detriment. So how do we now not go back to that, but really make them more accessible?
So NAI uses the acronym JEDI, Justice, Equity, Diversity, Accessibility, and Inclusion. One of the differences between JEDI and DEI is it includes the word accessibility. I'm curious to know. I mean, obviously, like you say, the world has changed a lot in the last 3 years. DEI, JEDI issues are very much on the forefront. I'm curious, when you focus specifically on accessibility, where are the areas of overlap with those other letters in the acronym, different kinds of inclusivity, and where are the areas where you really need to carve out a specific space for accessibility?
That's a really good question.
I was going to say, this is where Emily can edit if you need a moment to think about it, or if it's too big a question, for this space.
You know, again, back in 2016, when AAM put it into their strategic plan, it was DEIA. And then with everything that happened in 2020 with George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and all of that, the A sort of got lost. And it was often the thing to fall off anyway. So Danielle and I are on a mission to, make sure that the A is included, because you can be both, Black and disabled. You can be, whatever and have a disability. So it's not one or the other. And people kind of forget that sometimes, which is interesting. Yeah.
And I would say too, what's interesting is this idea of equity and equality, right? And there's a lot of things with accessibility that is equity. And it's not just equality. Every experience has to be the same. If you go into a museum exhibition and you have someone who is deaf, who is blind, who has sensory sensitivities, what they need is going to be very, very different. And so you can't just say, here's a one size fits all situation. We're an accessible museum. We have openings that are 36 inches. We have, so you have to think about this idea of equity. And I think that is what is a huge mind shift in DEI work, is you have to really think about, what are these individual things that people need? And I think a great example is thinking about sensory-friendly programming. And I've had these conversations a lot at my museum too, of saying, well, we're trying to be an inclusive institution. So we want to say, we need spaces for everybody. Everybody is welcome. Like, yes. And we've heard from this specific community of neurodiverse families, either families who have children or adults who are neurodiverse, that they also want to be able to come to a museum at any time. And they want to have a specific time where it is quiet, it is set aside. Usually it's before opening hours or after closing hours, that just their community can go. And it's because they don't want to have to apologize for how their kids are interacting. They don't want weird looks from visitors if their kid is using an oral fidget. So it's also like, how are we still always striving towards equality of, yes, we want to be in inclusive spaces. We want to think about all abilities, and we need to listen to our communities and what they say they need. And that can sometimes be, that can be tricky, because also then there's that question of, well, how do you prioritize which community? And I think, again, that goes to looking at Who are people who are coming to your space? Who are people not coming to your space? And how do you plan for that? But it's also this idea of, you know, it's not a pie where it's like, if I have a piece, that means Heather's not going to get a piece. It's like all of these practices can help us just think more about individuality and the way that we need to experience spaces and thinking about people. And that is in, you know, in partnership with all of these other initiatives and advocacy efforts that are not in competition.
You talk a lot about partnerships, and it's obviously super important to have the community involved in whatever you're doing from the beginning of the process. But I'm curious, did you come up with the phrase "nothing about us without us"?
No.
Is that you? Who is that? Because I use it all the time. And then when I was reading your book, I was like, wait a minute, because it's with partnerships, right? I think it's like partnerships part two or something like that. Where did that come from? Well, do you want to explain that a little bit and then tell me where it came from?
If I recall correctly, it came from, you know, sort of the early disability rights movement in the 60s. But there were also the 504 sit-ins in San Francisco and other cities, you know, trying to get the ADA to move along and get passed. I'm pretty sure that's where it came from. And it was disability rights activists basically saying, like, you're making all these decisions about us, but you're not including us. So nothing about us without us.
Gotcha. Thank you. I think we have a few more questions. I do want to know what is a good, like, if you think of like the perfect example of a place that has done this, maybe they've used universal design, I don't know, but a site that has really done this the best. Do you have any places that you can tell us about that are like the gold standard?
What's tricky is that we haven't been to all museums. So there are places we've heard about, but I haven't physically been. So the Canadian Museum of Human Rights is supposed to be a very, very progressive, universal design was like, you know, the basis of it. They have these different panels, but I haven't physically been there. What's difficult is I can point to museums who have done, there's this idea of like, their physical space is accessible or their digital space is accessible. And then they have exhibitions that focus on disability. And I've seen examples of both of those. I honestly haven't seen one space that is doing the physical design really well and talking about accessibility. Cause I think that's another level that we actually don't talk about in our book. Maybe the next book is how are museums also celebrating accessibility and what it brings. And the Cooper Hewitt in New York had a exhibition years ago, and I cannot remember now what it's called, but it was all about accessible design. And it was really looking at how designers have created things as simple as, you know, pill boxes or pill bottles, that the tops have two different ways that you can put them on. One that's you have to squeeze and turn, but then one that's much easier, and how that was the simple design change that opened up how people with, you know, manual dexterity issues, older adults, all these things could do it. And that I love because it's celebrating it. And I think that's where, again, as I mentioned about this sometimes separation between let's be accessible for visitors, but maybe not staff, is I'm also seeing it as, you know, how do we talk about people with disabilities who are in our world, in art museums? How are we celebrating how disability has actually changed how people see the world? How Claude Monet painted his water lilies because he had glaucoma, so he couldn't see huge parts of it, but he embraced it. And that I think is tricky, because then there's also, obviously I come from arts background, so that's my main focus, but is that a lot of people, because there's still a stigma, I don't want to be seen as a disabled artist only. I want to be seen as an artist, that is a change. And how are we talking about it and telling these narratives? And I think we're seeing it more and more, and sometimes they're at smaller organizations, but then also sometimes their physical accessibility isn't there because they are smaller and they don't have as many resources. So, but yeah, those are, I mean, the things that come to mind. I do think about the Olympic Museum in Colorado Springs is a way where it's very physically accessible. They do have a lot of ASL interpretation. I've also heard, I had a colleague who just came back from England, and it also sounds like in the UK there's quite a lot of focus on, you know, universal design as being kind of the starting point. So it's hard, but that's where I would invite listeners to share examples of places that they've seen so that we can build that up. Because there's only so many places, you know, that we can go to.
Well, and it goes back to funding too. You know, I was in France this last fall, and I was impressed by the number of just little museums that I went to that had amazing accessibility features. I think I sent Danielle a bunch of pictures. I was like, hey, look at this. You know, but they're federal, like they're government funded museums. So they're getting that buy-in from the very, very top. So that was interesting. Yeah, I feel, you know, like most museums, because they either have somebody who's just doing it or it's maybe part of their job. Like Danielle has it in her title. I don't have it in my title. Most people, you know, most museums don't have a person with accessibility in their title. That too is starting to change, kind of going back to your earlier question, Paul. But it's one of those things that I think, you know, there are places that do really, they're really good at deaf work, or they're really good at sensory work or that sort of thing. But because funding is often limited and resources are limited, it's not generally broad accessibility, if that makes sense.
Obviously, the book that you all wrote is specific to the museum field, which is, you know, obviously part of the larger interpretation world. What are the lessons from your book that can be applied to the larger interpretation world?
I mean, I think there's a lot of overlap in, you know, thinking about your community, who is coming to your space and what are their needs? How are you creating, whether it's smaller focus groups or advisory groups that are really saying, how are you accessing this space and what are the barriers and what are your opportunities? Thinking about content and how content is given. We have a chapter that's on cognitive access. And I think this is actually an area that is growing in all kind of interpretive fields, is how are we sharing the information in a way that the widest spectrum of people can access it. So how are you talking about what it is that you're interpreting in a way that people can understand? How do you use icons? How are you using visuals in a way? And then what are the tactile opportunities that you could have? Or what are the descriptive opportunities? I think about if you go to a zoo or an aquarium and you have, you know, these different live things, like how are you describing what they look like versus just assuming someone could see them or assuming someone is able to do them? How do you describe what the sunfish looks like we were talking about earlier? How do you describe the, you know, interactive spaces that the place has done? So there's a lot of overlaps. And I think also thinking about, you know, digital accessibility, how is your website really giving as much information as possible when someone, so that someone can feel prepared when they're coming? And I know, as we mentioned, I'm in San Francisco right now, so I'm traveling. So I'm playing that role. And I love playing that outsider role of going into spaces and recognizing, I've never been to this space. How do I know when it's open? How do I know if I have a question or if I have a need that I can have that information at hand? And I think that's something that all organizations, arts, culture, all of that need to think about, is just how are you, well, you know, preparing folks to come into your space and be successful with interacting with all that you have to offer.
Well, Heather and Danielle, thank you so much. This really has been fascinating and so interesting to hear about it. We've been talking a lot about your book. I would love to know where folks can find your book and where folks might be able to follow you on social media or online.
So you can find our book pretty much anywhere you can buy books. And you can find us online at museumaccessconsulting.com.
That's pretty easy. it's an audio medium, but for viewers at home, Danielle just gave a thumbs up. And interpreters.
That's
up. Not too bad. It wasn't too bad.
Not too bad. That wasn't too bad.